Welcome to Temple of Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Susan Kolb. Today I'm pleased to have back PMH Atwater with her newly released book, Future Memory. This is a book that is written as a labyrinth. If you go to www.plasticos.com, I believe we have the interview from last week up, and you can hear her talk about how she was able to write the book in this manner. And today we're going to talk about future memory. Welcome, PMH. Thank you for joining us again.
Oh, it's good to be there. It really, really is.
Well, I did enjoy the book a great deal. It was something that, you know, when you first mentioned future memory, I did not think that I had ever experienced this. But then I was reminded that several times when I was just about to injure myself, I would see the injury in great detail right before it happened.
Right.
So it was, this is a future memory, but it's like seconds before it actually happened. So I didn't really distinguish it as that far into the future. But that's what it was.
Well, you know, it can be that way. It can be something short-term, or it can be long-term.
You right.
Know, there, you know, it can span all kinds of time. One of the things that has me so excited is just last, oh, gee, what was it, a couple of weeks ago, the announcement came out from, it's from the Neuroscience Laboratory at Northwestern University in Illinois. And the scientist is Julia Moss Bridge. They came out with their findings. Now, they call it presentment. And they have found that presentment, without any external clues, can show what's going to happen in the future. In other words, a human being has the ability to predict future events without any visible clues at all as to what might happen. So we now know scientifically, this is not meditation or you know, dreamland or kind of knowing. We now know scientifically that the human being can respond to what's going to happen before it occurs. Now, what they found in their work was like maybe 20 seconds before, maybe 30 seconds before. But an interesting thing is HeartMath, who does a lot of work, scientific work on the heart and feelings, emotions, and this kind of thing in California, they found through their science that the heart, and we know now that the heart organ is literally our fifth brain, because most of the cells in the heart are neural cells. So, you know, that's just like the brain, so the heart is really a brain. It's now considered a brain. It's considered our fifth brain. That the heart responds to future events before they occur, again, about 30 seconds before, maybe 40 seconds before, sometimes a few minutes before the event actually happens. In other words, our heart is our first responder. So we now know that throughout the body, we pick up stuff. We know that the heart, I really think, is the first responder. That the heart truly, I feel, picks it up first. But they didn't find that at this university in Illinois. They were just looking at the entire body and how we respond to things, our nervous system and so forth. But we now have this science that is coming forward, and not calling it precognition or maybe clairvoyance or something else, but looking at the human body, you know, our physical body. We physically respond to the future before it happens. And I was just in correspondence with Julia Moss Bridge just a couple of days ago. And I was telling her how exciting this research is. And that I, sort of like, gee whiz, I wish you'd read my book, Future Memory. And I offered to send her a copy. She got a hold of me, and she said, it's because I read your first edition of Future Memory back in the 90s that you inspired this research to begin with. You know,
there
and I'm
go.
Going, twang. You know, that's sort of like the ultimate compliment.
Oh, sure, yeah.
But, you know, this idea, well, any kind of future, where you're, whether you're prophesying or you're forecasting or precognition
mm-hmm.
or clairvoyance or clairaudience, you know
mm-hmm.
any way we have to access the future, we have all these different names we put on it,
mm-hmm.
we now can also put on their future memory, where you're living the future before it occurs. All these kind of accessing of the future becomes very comfortable and very normal for anyone who's gone through a transformational event, especially near-death experiencers. This is one of the
mm-hmm.
after effects. And so I hope this book, Future Memory, opens the door to not only that this is fairly common,
mm-hmm.
but what it might mean and what's happening inside of us when this occurs, and again, what it appears to tell us about
mm-hmm.
consciousness and how consciousness is changing.
Well, before we talk about that, I want to just mention the idea of déjà vu, because as you mentioned in your book, déjà vu is different than future memory. Would you like to elaborate on that?
Déjà vu is past-oriented.
Right.
Future memory is always future-oriented.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, it can be sort of the same in that, people will maybe walking through a strange town, and they realize
mm-hmm.
they've already been there.
Right.
And it has to do with future or past lives or, you know, mm. biolocation of the soul
yeah.
or whatever.
Right.
But future memory is different not only in the sense that it is future-oriented. In other words,
mm-hmm.
something that, you know, may not happen for a few minutes or maybe a few hours or maybe a few months, and you're suddenly living it before it occurs.
Mm-hmm.
But also because there's a physiological component. And this is what I think is so important. There are physical sensations that tell you this is happening or going to happen if you get the full whammy. Now, I'm not talking here necessarily about clairvoyance, clairaudience, and that kind
mm-hmm.
of thing. But I'm talking specifically about if you're picking up the future through future memory. In other words, if you're really about to live what is going to happen somewhere down the road, you're going to live that right now.
Mm-hmm.
There are physical sensations that tell you it's going to happen
mm-hmm.
During it. Afterward, and there are after effects. And as a researcher, I'm pointing at this and I'm saying, this is extremely important. Usually, there's a rush of heat when it's about to happen, or somehow a feeling of exhilaration or something strange is going to occur. Usually begins in the feet, but with a lot of people, just the lower body trunk. So it always sweeps upward. And
mm-hmm.
you know, many people say it's sort of burst through the top of the head. They often feel as if they're lifting. Some people hear a ringing sound in their ears.
Right.
And there's this stoppage. There's a stoppage of time and space. It's like the air fills up with sparkles and everything else becomes brighter. The sense of faculties heighten. And there's this feeling that, you know, things are expanding. Somehow they're becoming larger and stronger and you expand and so does space, but time just seems to fade away. It's like time isn't anymore, but space takes on larger, more expansive qualities. And then the future episode happens, and you live through it. I mean, in detail, you live through it, you process it. It's just like, you really can't tell the difference between regular living and future memory living, because they're virtually the same. And then when the event is over, then time and space relationships resume. Space returns to its rightful proportion. Time is back. But there's this after effect of a puzzle, like being startled or chilled or you know, something weird happened here or different. Don't know quite what to do with it. A lot of people will forget it. Some people kind of, it's sort of like a lingering memory until the event actually occurs. And then it all comes back, you know, with this big flood, like, I've done this before.
Right.
Yeah, you know, and the resolution is almost in there. Well, it's uncomfortable at first, with most people. They're uncomfortable the first few times, but if they have it several times, then it becomes very comfortable. It's almost as if, like, you develop a kind of sense of awe that there's something very right with the world, and that, you know, you just sort of fit in the flow of things. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to give some examples, because, you know, I can talk and talk. All people are doing is hearing words, and then we get these examples, and then people go, oh, well, maybe that happened to me, too. There's been a lot of them happen to me, but one of them I like to talk about happened when I was looking for a job. My husband and I were living in Williamsburg, Virginia, and it was a sunshiny morning. I think it was a Saturday morning or something like that, and we were sitting down having breakfast, and my husband, unfortunately, had the newspaper up, so he didn't see me. But I'm sitting at the table, and suddenly I'm hearing the phone ring. And the phone is in the kitchen, so I just walk a few feet, go over, answer the phone. And it's this guy who my husband thought I could apply for work with. He was just coming down, I think, from New York City or something like that, to the area. He was going to take over this particular timeshare or real estate kind of program, and he needed workers in the field, and my husband had submitted my name. So he called on the phone, said, we're going to get together that night. I think it was like something like 7 o'clock that night at Howard Johnson's in downtown Williamsburg, and, you know, would I be there? And so I busied myself vacuuming and going all over the house and taking care of everything. And when 7 o'clock came, I got in my car and I drove over to Howard Johnson's and I parked it and got inside the restaurant and was looking all over for him, couldn't find him, and turned around suddenly and looked back at these big glass doors, and he was walking in surrounded by a bevy of women. Mm-hmm. And then I was just so startled, because I'm still sitting. I'm still sitting at the breakfast nook table at my husband, you know, holding this newspaper, and I'm, you know, Terry, did you see anything? Did you hear anything? Did you hear the phone ring? Anything? And he puts the paper down and looks at me kind of funny. He says, no, I didn't hear anything. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm thinking to myself, oh, this must have been a dream. You know, or I'm just kidding myself, or, you know, daydream or this kind of stuff. So it's like a week later, maybe, I get this phone call. And so I go to the phone, and it's this guy from New York. And he said, well, you know, we've decided how all the people get together that might work on this project. It's 7 o'clock at Howard Johnson's. Can you be there? And I said, sure. So I go around, I vacuum the house, and I do different things, and I finally get in the car, and I drive over to Howard Johnson's and park my car, and I walk in Howard Johnson's, and I look all over for him, couldn't find him. So I turn around, and there he is, walking through these big glass doors surrounded by a bevy of women.
Right.
So this wasn't in the future memory episode. So I walk over to the guy who just walked in those big glass doors. I'm very excited. And I said, oh, you know, I can hardly wait to get together and talk with you about the program. I think it's going to be a really neat program, and I'm just glad to be here.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy, no kidding, Dr. Cope, the guy went ghost white. And he stepped back, and his eyes were wild, and he looked at me kind of funny, and he says, there's no way you can know who I am. There is no way you can know about this program tonight. This is not, you cannot possibly know who I am. And, you know, from that day on, I worked that program for about 2 months, maybe 2.5 months. From that day on, he would not be in the same room with me.
He was scared of you, huh?
He was afraid of me.
Hmm. Well, fear is a common emotion even when people talk about near-death experiences, some other people listening to them experience fear.
Right.
I mean, fear is just shutting down because they don't want to disturb reality.
Well, he absolutely knew I could not know what he looked like.
Right.
He was right, except he was wrong.
I just
had a future memory episode.
Exactly.
And I noticed this with so many near-death experiencers. In other words, it's one of the after effects. So I got to thinking after a while in my work, I wonder if other people who don't have near-death experiences or don't even go through transformational experiences, do they have it too? And I put in some ads in newspapers and magazines and began to mention this on the talks I was giving around the country. And I found a number of people replied. In fact, it seemed to be running families, and they would go back for generations. They all had this kind of episodes occur. I found this James Van Avery. He's an engineer and a scientist. He developed a technique for causing this to occur. And by the way, it's in the book. There's a special chapter on James Van Avery's technique.
Mm-hmm.
And, but, you know, what really interested me was the different ways that this can occur. And this one woman, I think she was in the Seattle area or somewhere, she'd had one of these where she was standing at the kitchen, busying herself in the kitchen, and suddenly she had pre-lived. Her husband was going to go to a meeting that night, and he was driving himself there. And he had an accident, and he was hurt and had to be rushed to the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And she was so concerned and so frightened by this that when he got home from work, and he told her then, she didn't know about this, he told her then that he had to attend this meeting tonight, don't worry about it, everything would be well, and she just panicked. And she said, oh, I want to go with you, and she drove.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing happened. So she thought, oh, yeah, I prevented this. You know, breathe this big sigh of relief. And then in the following week, the same thing happened in that he had a sudden meeting. This time he didn't tell her.
Right.
And he drove. And the accident occurred.
Mm-hmm.
And he was rushed to the hospital. So she was saying to me, I didn't change the event. All I did was change the timing.
And that brings up the idea that some events may be set in time. Or, well, that's not true. Some events may be set, but the time
is variable.
Yeah. And the idea of fate and destiny, which I explore in the book, is, you know, which is what? What can we prevent or what can we intervene in? And are there events that occur that we cannot change or alter, that rather these events are necessary for our development? We're going to go through them, but what we can change is how we feel about it, what we do about it, and interestingly enough, when we do that, we somehow change the event.
Right, yeah. Well, theoretically, if the event was to occur so that you would learn a lesson, if you learned the lesson ahead of time, the event may evaporate, you know.
That's
possibly.
That certainly is a possibility. I mean, none of us can say for sure.
Yeah,
but it just seems to me like certain things are bound to happen, or at least need to happen, or will happen. But as we change them, even those that are fated, supposedly. You know, I look back at my own life and say, you know, there's no way I could have changed this, this, and this. They would have happened no matter what I did or what I thought. But because of how I processed them and dealt with them afterward, their after effects changed.
Yeah.
So, you know.
And I suspect that there could be some events that are agreed upon by great groups of people.
And
greater the group of people agreeing that the event should occur, the harder it would be for, say, anything other than the great group of people to change the event. So therefore, you know, what you or I do isn't going to change it.
Right.
You know, that idea that maybe, you know, the Twin Towers coming down or the, you know, some of the bigger events in history may actually be set more forcefully. And the WebBot project, I think I mentioned this to you last week, the WebBot project thinks that whenever these things are really, really big and important in our, you know, subsequent lives, that they send out more of a signal that can be detected, you know, in terms of how the WebBot process does, you know, does what they do.
Well, the global mind, you know, and Princeton, and they set up all these little machines all over the world, and we they were able to show that mass mind, the whole group of us, bunches of groups of us, do pick up what's going to occur before it occurs.
Right.
We get the message. We respond. I certainly found that out as a researcher with 9/11. People were dreaming about that, even the Twin Towers, even a year before it occurred.
Right.
And certainly
so
a few months before it occurred.
Right. So the bigger the event that is going to shock us, because most of all of us were at least more shocked by that than other things across the country, even across the world. So if the event's very big, then the emanations of that event going back in time and affecting people in their dreams, in their daydreams, in their, you know, whatever, in the way that the Princeton random number generators, you know, became less random, you know, all of that, you know, occurs to a greater degree when the event is very big. And I would assume, I mean, I can't prove this, but I would assume that that event being so big and affecting so many people in such an emotional way would be harder to avert.
Yeah.
I
wrote a little e-book about it. It's on my website called The Challenge of September 11, because I went over there. I'm one of these people that I can, project myself over there. I can project my soul, my body, my essence. I can project myself over there, and I did. And, you know, my report is in September 11. But you know, we can surmise and think and know and follow these kind of trackings, and they're wonderful to do because they give you a different sense of history and a different mm-hmm. sense of our being here. But one of the things that I do a lot in future memories, bring it down to the personal and bring it down to the everyday activities in our lives, who we mm-hmm. are as human beings. And I take a look at, okay, how can we live the future before it occurs? This isn't a revelation. This is a physical onset. This is a physical activity that is processed physically.
Mm-hmm.
So as a researcher, I have to pull back and say, now, wait a minute here. I can deal with clairvoyance and clairaudience and all these kinds of things, but what about future memory?
Mm-hmm.
What is that telling me? So I was doing a lot of research at the time with children
mm-hmm.
and brain development. And one of the things I noticed was that the average child between the ages of, let's say 3 and 4 years old, especially around 4 years old, even 5 years old, spends more time in the future than they do in the present.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they're acting out future events or ideas or feelings or thoughts. They want to act out all these stories. And you know, when you really take a look at the brain and what's happening in the brain, before I go on with that, I want to insert here that I find it very interesting that with the very young, those are the ages where we have most of the reports about near-death experiences, alien mm-hmm. visitations, fairies and goblins, all these kind of otherworldly kind of events occur in those same ages.
Mm-hmm.
And if we take a look at what's happening in the brain, of course, we've got a lot of things going on, especially with the limbic system. But what I'm recognizing is that children who do this, who spend a lot of time in the future, who pre-live the future on a regular basis,
mm-hmm.
And play with futuristic possibilities, they do this as a way of getting ready. It's a rehearsal. They are rehearsing in advance for demands soon to be made upon them. That they don't have any natural understanding of time-space. So they consider future an aspect of now. To them, that's now. This is really happening. In play-acting, we call it play-acting, we call this their imagination. But in acting out the future before it occurs, this is how they gain perspective.
Mm-hmm.
This is how they are aware of continuity by establishing the validity of future. They are able to then recognize and accept scenery, connected wholes, that this is a world, these are our parents, this is where we live, this is what mm-hmm. human beings are, this is what buildings are. They really do a lot of establishing of continuity, what is real and what isn't real, and then mm-hmm. they rehearse future events as if they were happening right now. Their play acting is literally a rehearsal. Well, when I took a real good look at near-death experiences, of course, that's my forte, but also anyone who's gone through an impactful transformational event, no matter what cost it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm noticing that people come back from these a little confused and a little bewildered. It's a big thing to happen. And how do you process it? What do you do with it? Sort of throws you off stride. It introduces you to greater realities than you ever really thought existed. You, you know, you get a big, fat stretch.
But it's not just the event. When you come back into reality, reality itself has changed.
Right. And so many of these people relive the future in some capacity,
mm-hmm.
whether they're developing, you know, suddenly developing precognition or clairvoyance or clairaudience or whatever, all of a sudden the future becomes important or comfortable or happens a lot or is scary, doesn't matter how we accept it, the fact is it's happening. And what I've noticed with these people is that, just like the kids, we begin to pre-experience life's challenges and opportunities as a way of preparing to meet future demands.
Mm-hmm.
With an adult, they're no longer restricted by that sense of time-space states. So they're ready, or at least it helps them to embrace broader dimensions of experience and future. It enables them to be, I'm going to say healthier. It enables them to be more together, more integrated. This
mm-hmm.
comfortableness with the future, or at least accessing more of the future, actually enables us to be more integrated, to settle down,
mm-hmm.
To be more comfortable in our bodies and in our worlds. We've changed. We've gone through this huge change. Now the world is so different. Okay, how do you handle it? Where does the continuity come from? Where does the perspective come from? It's not
mm-hmm.
magic. We begin then to do the same thing kids do it around the age of 3, 4, and 5. And I believe for exactly the same reason. This is how we establish continuity. This is how we accept contrast. This is how we then form perspective. And to me, this is just so important. I mean, you know, when you're coming back from these transformational events, you go through this period, some quicker than others, of being confused, or how do you handle it, or how do you talk to people, or how do you live, how do you work? You're not the same. Life isn't the same. Where are your benchmarks? And so many of us go through periods where we think, oh, I'm going crazy. You know, how do you even talk to people? People then do think you're crazy when you try to talk to them because you don't know what to say anyway. And it's this propensity, this ability of our bodies and our brain, and I believe our mind, the whole assembly, then to revert back to what we did as children. Because when we do that, that enables us to handle this new world we're walking into, i.e. the same world that always was there, but we're new. So as far as we're concerned, it's a new world. And we walk into that, prepare for it, integrate it in the same manner we did as kids. And it all hangs on future. And I came to realize that it is absolutely necessary for all of us to be comfortable with things future. As we do that, we are better able to handle these new revelations, these new perspectives that we gain. This ability to be more comfortable with the future instead of frightened of it It's what enables our brains and our mind to readjust and our bodies to readjust. It's not just, you know, a funny little flip thing of, you know, I'm able to live the future before it occurs. You know, that seems kind of flippant. But yeah, when we look at it and realize, wait a minute here, this is part of growing up. As kids, we're growing up. You know, we're rehearsing. We're getting prepared. Well, as adults, what are we growing up to? We're growing up to be who we really are. You know, that door is now open to be our real self, our true self, the higher self, the soul. And as we adjust to that reality, and as we then become, or at least express more fully, who and what we really are, we're really growing up to that idea of individuation, that we are individuating. You know, as kids, we're moving into stereotypical models. We have to. That's a process of self-discovery for kids. Mm-hmm. When we're a transformational experiencer, we are moving into individuation. Sort of like the journey of self-discovery. I should say not self-discovery, soul discovery. We're moving up then into those spiritual planes and those spiritual realities. And, you know, it thrilled me to realize that we really do have a way to adapt to this.
Mm-hmm.
That's not something that we have to make a big deal of. This is automatic. This happens. And instead of being frightened by it or confused by it, come to realize that, you know, this is part of the process
of waking up.
Yeah, and reestablishing
up. Yeah.
What
you're describing is a shift in perceptual reality, because we are perceiving more of what is there than we perceived earlier.
Right, right. We recognize only what we are prepared in advance to see.
Mm-hmm.
When we're looking at perception, what I love is meditation. You know, in that chapter on, it's called Illusions of Perception.
Mm-hmm.
Meditation and contemplation and skills and practices like this really train, or I should say retrain, our ability to see both motion and rest at the same time. You know, we get into tricks of perception, illusions of perception. Movies, for instance, is an illusory event. We go to a movie to see the actors act out this great play or this great story, and what is it that we're really seeing there?
Mm-hmm.
Only single units exist. There's no such thing as movement.
Mm-hmm.
All they can shoot onto that screen are single units of pictures. It's our the ability of, I think it's called the reticular activating system. Well, it's part of, it's a little bit lower than the limbic system, but it's part of our brain, and it's called perceptual prejudice. It's where our perception links everything together when it's really not together. The same way with television. It's the same way with concerts and music. All our brain can process, because all that is being given to us are single units with rest in between.
Right.
You know, flash on, flash off, flash on, flash off. We don't see that. all we see is continuous scenery, and it's our brain that makes it continuous, because
right.
it's not. It's just flashes. And when you really get into that, you realize that the universe is always flashing on and off and on and off.
Mm-hmm.
And that the purpose of meditation or skills like that is to enable you to view simultaneously and separately at the same time. So you can see the connection and you can see the disconnection both at the same time.
Yeah, meditation allows you to slow things down so that you can capture the thoughts that are really important. When I don't meditate, things go real fast and I fail to capture them, but that information is very important. And when I meditate a lot, I can capture them, and then the thought, say, you know, you need to check that burner again, or you need to make sure the garage door was shut. You know, those thoughts are very important because actually the garage door came back up, and so the house is unsecure, you see?
Right, but meditation also enables you to recognize scenery, realities,
mm-hmm.
and be able to see the greater truth about that reality. Not just
right.
that you didn't connect the garage door, but looking out your door or looking out the window, you can then see all of the in-between. And it's that in-between is where truth lies. It's that incredible in-between.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what other word to use except in-between. In-between motion and rest, there is a space, or I should say a non-space, a crack, if you will. And if you can slip into that crack, that's where you get into the truth of what's really there. And meditation, I feel, enables us to slip into that crack. Sometimes
mm-hmm.
other forms of being quiet, or maybe sometime you're really active. You know, you can be in Zen and be really active. I used to do this all the time. You know, you can go into gamma levels of meditation as well as delta. In other words, you can slow things really down, or you can
mm-hmm.
speed things really up.
Mm-hmm.
Meditation can go both ways. And I really love high-speed meditation. So you're moving, you know, you're getting things going really fast. One of the ways I did this was, or still do every once in a while, is I go out and take a walk. And, I'm out in nature, doesn't matter where I am. And I speed up. So that I'm walking pretty fast. But I'm
mm-hmm.
walking at a good rhythmic pace. And I'm really just going really fast. And as I'm doing that, then I free my mind. I free my mind by thinking it so. I open the doors of my mind, and I let it spread. And when it spreads, I become every blade of grass. I become every tree. I become every rock, every post, every house. I become the pavement. I become the sky. I become the air. I become the clouds. Everything is me. And I go into that sense of allness and totalness. And when I do that, when I am truly, fully everything that is there, that's when you slip in that crack. That's
mm-hmm.
when you're in that in-between. And pow! Pow! You're really there.
You're in the flow.
You're more than in the flow. You are the flow.
Right.
And it's so powerful. So you can, you know, I can do the meditation thing, and I do, where I get, you know, really slow and into delta.
Mm-hmm.
Or I can do I can practice Zen where I'm going into high gamma. And it's just, you know, either way, it's just wonderful. But you know, when you do this kind of thing, you know, I don't know about you, but my mind dances on, you know, what is this world? Why are we here? What's going on? And I was able to do that in future memory. That's what the book is. But, you know, for me, the wonderful thing about the book is that the way it's written, you know, I didn't concoct that.
Right.
I didn't name the book. I didn't concoct
right.
that.
Right. Yeah.
You know, like I said last time, that voice that spoke to me in my third near-death experience showed me how to turn this book that I had tried seven different times to write it and wouldn't hold together, showed me how to turn the book into a labyrinth. Well, in doing that, in the book being a labyrinth, then it becomes an adventure book. It becomes fun to read, and yet it works on you, just like walking a sight labyrinth. It begins working on your brain and your mind, and it frees you and opens up all kinds of little passageways. The average person says it takes about, you know, 2 weeks for the full effect or a more visible effect to occur. Some people get it right away, where it literally works on you just like walking a sight labyrinth. If you walk a sight labyrinth, you come out of that different than the way you went in. Well, it's the same way with future memory. You come out of that book different than the way you went in. And I came to realize that the book is really a psychotronic device. It's like a living organism, or at least allows you to live differently as you're in it, because it's working on your brain as you are reading it and helping you to rise to that next highest level of consciousness possible for you.
Yeah.
So there's personal stories in the book. But in each and every one, we're confronting, okay, what's really happening? You know, here's the story. What's really happening in the story?
Right.
And what does it show us about us?
Now, in the book, you talk about Edgar Cayce saying there's time, space, and patience.
Yeah.
You want to elaborate on what patience is?
No. You know, nobody has been able to figure out what he meant.
Mm-hmm.
So let's face that. Nobody figured out what the dimension of patience was. I did when I was when I was making sweet pickles. You know, I was making these 14-day sweet pickles, only I was making them 15-day sweet pickles so that they were really crisp and really sweet. And, you know, I was busy making these pickles, and I had this big, huge vat of a pan on the stove, and it was boiling away, and I happened to turn my back. I forget now what I was doing, and the darn thing boiled over. And this was the last day of the processing, so, you know, 15 days worth of sugar boiled over. And, it, you know, went in through the burner and the stove and the, you know, and underneath the stove and the oven. And, I mean, that gooey stuff was everywhere. And instead of screaming, which would have been my normal retort, I just suddenly went into that high gamma, that same thing I was telling you about. When I walk, I went into the in-between, and it was gauze-like. And there was a smell there, kind of an ozone kind of smell. And I walked in my mind, well, no, literally, I walked into that space place. That every when that poet, you know, Snyder He invented that word every when, and I think it's a wonderful word. I think it's Gary Snyder is his name, I think. And I was there in that space. And in that space, I cleaned up the mess. And it was effortless. It was easy. It was so effortless. It was almost like magic. I mean, I moved the stove. I cleaned up everything. This huge vat. I mean, I'm not talking a little pan here. Mm-hmm. I'm talking a big vat that was much larger than a burner. Huge pan. Tall, big, huge, almost like a witch's cauldron. And how long did it take me? I think it was around 5 minutes, 5 to 7 minutes. I forget now how long it took. It should have been on the clock maybe half an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And it only took like 4 or 5 minutes. And when I came out of that and noticed the time, the physical time on the clock, that's when I knew what patience was.
Mm.
It is a different realm. It is that realm of every when that poet Gary Snyder talks about. It is what we know now, I think, as either torsion waves or something like that, that enable, it's that fifth basic force that I talked about in Children of the Fifth World.
Mm-hmm.
It's that wave force or, what do you call it, what are words? It is that space place. Pulse that carries information, that warps time and space, that enables DNA to talk to each other, that enables brains and minds and souls to be in communication with each other, that enables the universe to know itself, that enables consciousness to know itself, that idea of torsion waves. And it was either that or something like that, that that's what patience is.
Mm.
You know, if you're feeling patient, you kind of calm down, things don't bother you that much. But if you go further into patience, which is what Casey did, you recognize that it's truly every when. And in that sense, it is the third dimension, you know, time, space, and patience,
and
the
patience,
third dimension that
right.
he was talking about.
Right. And you mentioned Bentoff in the book, and Bentoff was one of the most amazing people that ever lived, in my opinion. And he concluded, as you did in one of your, as you saw, you didn't conclude, you actually saw it, that the universe is most likely a giant torus.
Right.
And that is, I think that's really important to understand in what people are observing in near-death experiences or transcendent experiences. Do you want to talk just for a few minutes
about
that?
Well, you know, how we move in and out of that torus is the torsion waves.
Right, exactly.
That's the movement, and that's what Casey was trying to describe, this time-space.
Right, the movement, right.
Right. Taurus is like a big donut.
Right.
You know, it's like this giant donut. And that everything kind of moves in and out of that donut, and no, I don't know how to explain it in a couple of minutes.
You have to actually see the pictures.
Yeah.
I mean, the pictures are in your book, so we'll just refer people to your book if you want to understand the universe, life, and everything. How's that?
You know, Future Memory is
picture.
This wonderful adventure book that enables
right.
you to face yourself as you never have before.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I don't know how else to put it than that.
Mm-hmm.
And to tantalize you with the idea that the book is alive and it's going to work on you as you read it.
Mm-hmm. It's got wonderful stories in it. I really love the stories. I like the wasp story.
Yeah, Dr. Vernon Silvest. Yeah. He went into the mind of the wasp and had a conversation.
A little conversation with the wasp. I think that's important to know you can do that. It could save your life if you're allergic to wasp stings.
Oh.
Anyway, would you like to give your contact information?
Well, my website, of course, www.pmhatwater.com. That's P as in Paul, M as in Mary, H as in Howard. So it's PMH at Water. Yes, PMH is really my name. And on that website is you can subscribe to my free monthly newsletter. So you can do that on the website. The website has lots of different sections to it, including an online bookstore. But you can get my books anywhere. You don't just have to give them off my website. You know, you can save yourself a little money, and you can get it from Amazon or these other places, except that if you go there, you don't get my autograph. If you go online,
that's right. one little thing.
Yes.
Yep. Well, and you have many books. You know, you've got a number of books on near-death experience. You've researched on near-death experience, almost 4,000 interviews with people having near-death experiences and what you found.
Kids and adults both. And then working with the new children and evolution and genetics and 3 books on that. And I'm just one of these folk that I'm just very, very curious. And I want to know why. But then once I've done my work, then I want to test it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm just one of those folks.
Yeah, spiritual growth and is evident in your books. Spiritual growth is not by reading and memorizing, it's more by experiencing.
Right.
And that's why this book is good, because it allows you to go into that realm of experiencing.
Right, right. This is the one and only that I've written like this.
Mm-hmm.
And the one and
only
that,
very
that I
to
know
do that.
Of like this. I mean, I don't know of any other book written like this.
No, I don't either.
And, you know, I could have never done it. It was that voice like none other that showed me how. It's
right.
all math. It's all mathematics. And I could have never done it. It was a voice that showed me how. So, amen.
Well, that's kind of like the Course in Miracles. You know, if you look at the way the Course in Miracles is written, it's real obvious that no human wrote it. You know?
my husband is a facilitator of a study group every Tuesday night. Yeah, that's his comments as well. I happen to be an Ernest Holmes fan myself. And where he would always, you know, same subject, just handled a different way.
Right,
more practical people like myself.
Mm-hmm.
His invitation is, it's not enough that you know it, you got to demonstrate. And he would always emphasize demonstration, and that's where I come from. It's like, it's not enough to know this, to believe this, to see it.
Right.
You got to be able to take it into the world of effects, and does it work? And if it doesn't work, why doesn't it work? So I'm very much into demonstration.
Yeah. Well, thank you for writing the book. I enjoyed it, and I think it's one that a lot of people can benefit from.
Well, I'd love to come to your area someday if you know any conference people or those kind of folk who would like to bring me down.
Sure.
I'd love to come and see everybody.
Sure. We have once a year a conference called Beyond the Veil.
Well, you ought to get a hold of it and sponsor
it. I'll mention it to them. But it certainly would fit in, because you have traveled beyond the veil.
Yeah, kind of, sort of.
Yes, Yes, kind of, sort of, right.
Yeah,
well, thank
yeah.
you so much for joining us again today, especially on short notice. Philip Coppens, who I was supposed to interview, passed on, so I had
We lost another giant.
Yes,
January
yes, we
24,
did.
Michael Toms of New Dimension.
Right.
Yeah,
well, doing work in another dimension, I'm sure.
That's right.
Well, anyway,
okay,
thanks
dear,
so
thank
much.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Next week, we are interviewing Harry Massey, Choice Point, Align Your Purpose. And then on the 16th, Dr. Nicholas Gonzalez, What Went Wrong? The Truth Behind the Clinical Trials of the Enzyme Treatment of Cancer. Dr. Gonzalez has a great success in treating pancreatic cancer along with other cancers, but he certainly can tell you why this information was suppressed. On the 23rd of February, we're interviewing Dr. Rita Louise, Man-Made, The Chronicles of Our Extraterrestrial Gods. We have a meetup, Abraham Hicks Group, every Wednesday at 7:30 at the Dunwoody office. And Noetic Science Meeting is a free lecture on Sasquatch, the X Factor. Lee Culver is giving this. He has given several other Noetic Sciences that were very well attended. And then Dr. Mike is giving a free lecture called The Five Keys to Permanent Weight Loss. That's on the 26th at 7:30, again at the Dunwoody office. This is Dr. Susan Kolb with Temple of Health Radio Show. Please join us next week.